So did this work in collaboration with David Kutasov, Govind and Rajesh, Micha Berkus, and Bert Overath. And let me start with a few words of motivation. There's a number of conceptual issues surrounding the concept of a Big Bang. Should we think about it as the beginning of time, or was there a large universe before we then shrunk to a singularity and expanded again? A related question, in particular in the context of string theory, is how we should define observables in a space-time with a Big Bang. Should we impose some initial conditions close to the singularity, or should we rather define S-matrix-type objects using asymptotic regions? And the type of Big Crunch, Big Bang space-times I'll be talking about has received a fair amount of attention recently in the context of the pre-Big Bang scenario, and in particular in ekpyrotic and cyclic cosmology. And there an outstanding question, as we've heard before in this conference, is what fluctuation spectra do, how they are related before and after the bounds, if there is a bounds at all. And finally, we were motivated by trying to construct some toy models of positive cosmological constant in string theory, but I won't emphasize this aspect in this talk. So what I'll do is construct a specific string theory model of a Big Crunch, Big Bang. I will show how you can truncate it to obtain a more conventional four-dimensional FRW cosmology. I will construct global wave functions for scalar fluctuations and use those to quantize the system and to study particle creation. Then I'll go back to the four-dimensional cosmology and study the fluctuation spectra of scalar fluctuations. I will argue that there's some version of information loss at work in these models. And finally, I will comment on the important issue of back reaction. So before going into the string theory, let me start from its low energy effective action, which describes gravity, a dilaton, and I will choose a positive cosmological constant, which in string theory can be done by working with supercritical strings. A particular solution I'll be interested in is given by the following metric and dilaton. And let me just outline the asymptotic behavior. For very early and very late times, this is just flat space with a dilaton that varies linearly in time. On the other hand, for t going to zero, I have the following metric and a constant dilaton, and this metric just describes two wedges of Minkowski space, the so-called Milne universe. Now it's possible to introduce new coordinates and extend the space-time in the following way. Introducing these UV coordinates and extending their range of validity from minus infinity to plus infinity, I find the following expression for the metric and the dilaton. And in terms of a space-time diagram, we get the following. So U equals V equals zero is just a regular point of this geometry, as we've seen before. But there are curvature and string coupling singularities on these wiggly lines, UV equals one. And in fact, this space-time is closely related to the two-dimensional black hole, as becomes manifest by rotating this diagram by 90 degrees. And that will, in fact, play an important role later on. Now, the last step in the construction is to do a periodic identification in terms of the UV coordinates. I identify them as follows. In terms of the original x coordinates, this is just a periodic identification. And this brings the space-time diagram above to the following form. So we have, so these are two of the space-time dimensions. We have a circle of constant size asymptotically, which then shrinks to zero size and expands again. But on top of that, we find two intermediate regions which have closed time-like curves, and two additional asymptotic regions, one future region and one past region. And I will call this the generalized Milne orbifold, because close to the UV equals zero singularity, this looks like the Milne orbifold, which just consists of four cones touching at the tips. So this was the low energy effective field theory, let me now argue that this solution is an exact solution of classical string theory. To do that, I'm going through three steps. First, start with the PSL2R group manifold, which consists of 2x2 matrices with unit determinant and the following identification. Strings on a group manifold like that can be described by a WCW model. Now, starting from that, gauge a U1 symmetry of the WCW model, this one, and in a certain gauge, the resulting coset conformal field theory has a description in terms of a sigma model with the following target space. This is the metric, this is the dilaton. Let me make a couple of comments about this. First, in the worldsheet supersymmetric version, which I'm implicitly working with, this sigma model defines an exact conformal field theory. There's no alpha prime corrections. Second, K, the level of the affine algebra in the construction, I will choose to be the following negative number in order to reproduce the metric I had before. So I'll be interested in WCW models at negative level. And third, since K is negative, the central charge of these two dimensions is smaller than 2. So we know that to get a consistent string theory, the total central charge should equal 10. So I have to do something to the transverse directions. Two possibilities are the following. I can choose to work with a flat transverse space, but then I have to work with more than 8 transverse directions. And that's what I'll do in this talk for simplicity. However, there's other possibilities. If one wants to stay within critical string theory, one can do it by choosing, for instance, 2 of the transverse directions to be curved and to be described by the cigar conformal field theory. And in some respects, this is a cleaner string theory model. But as I said, I will concentrate on the first option in this talk. And finally, I have to make the periodic identification, which is a conventional string theory orbifold. Okay, so this completes the string theory construction of this background. Let me now outline how one can relate it to a four-dimensional cosmology. I will look at a time-like trajectory starting in this early time region 1 and going to the late time region 2. And I will compactify on this Milne circle. Of the other dimensions, I will choose 3 to be large. So this will be the large space directions. And the others I will compactify for simplicity on a torus. And let me, for simplicity, choose all the radii to be equal to some exponential sigma t. Let me denote the radius of the Milne circle by exponential sigma r. Then there's a third scalar field of interest, namely the effective four-dimensional dilaton. And if I now truncate the string theory to only those fields and the metric, I find an effective four-dimensional action, which contains an exponential potential for one of these scalar fields. Of course, we don't believe this picture to be valid everywhere. In particular, close to the t equals 0 singularity, it should break down for one thing because there's going to be light winding modes over there. The background solution I mentioned before corresponds in these variables to the following solution. The radius of the torus doesn't do anything. The radius of the Milne circle goes to zero size. At t equals zero, the dilaton starts out at the bottom of its exponential potential, goes all the way up to the top at t equals zero, and then rolls back. And the metric is conformally flat, and it has a scale factor that vanishes at t equals zero. So that's the big crunch in these variables. This is indeed the four-dimensional Einstein frame. That's right. I started from the 10-dimensional string frame, and this is the four-dimensional Einstein frame.
So originally it was third-dimensional series.
Well, or higher than 10 dimensionally.
And now you reduce it. The four dimensions are also went to Einstein frame.
Exactly.
And you put Einstein series is 2 scalar
fields. Yes, 3 scalar fields. Yes. So if I study this four-dimensional model by itself, I would say that it has a time-varying equation of state, which from early times has W equals minus a third, so it's on the verge of inflating, but it doesn't inflate. At T equals zero, it goes up to W equals one, where it's kinetic energy dominated, and then it goes back down. Another quantity of interest is the Hubble radius, which takes the following form in conformal time. And by comparing this with the physical wavelength of particles, one can convince oneself that for very early times, modes with large enough Coulombian momentum are inside the horizon, whereas the others are frozen. At T equals zero, all modes have come outside the horizon, and some of them go inside again at later times. Now, what's the question I will be asking about this? We can look at scalar fluctuations around this background, and in particular, one is interested in correlation functions, for instance, the two-point function and different points in space. And in particular, the question will be, what is this two-point function before the crunch? What is it after the crunch? Because we won't know what it is in this question mark region from the point of view of the four-dimensional description. And what is the relation between the two? And the strategy will be to use the full string theory description to address this question. So let me go back to the string theory, or in a first step to the low energy effective description to construct globally defined wave functions. So to the Dirac-Thon gravity action I started from, I will add this action for a scalar field in this background. And as a warm-up exercise, let me solve the wave equation in one of the regions, say region 1 or region 2. This is the equation. The solutions are hypergeometric functions. And let me just outline the asymptotic behavior at early and late times and at t equals 0. For early or late times, the solutions are just plane waves multiplied by a factor of the string coupling. And one thing to point out is that this energy for a few modes can be imaginary. And these modes, which were the frozen modes before, are tachyons and presumably correspond to instabilities of this model. However, this is an artifact of working with these supercritical strings, and it has nothing to do with the cosmological singularity I'll be interested in, so I will just ignore this issue in this talk. I think there are some interesting questions there, but let's not go into them now. So the modes I'll be concentrating on are the oscillating modes with positive energy squared. Now, close to the Big Crunch singularity, as we've seen before in this conference, the wave functions either oscillate an infinite number of times or diverge logarithmically, depending on their momentum along the middle in the circle. And this is singular behavior. For instance, if you compute a zero-zero component of the stress tensor, it diverges like 1 over t squared. So these are the solutions to the wave equation in one of the regions. Now, the question will be, how do I match solutions of the wave equations in the various regions? And the fact that they are singular, close to t equals 0, makes it not obvious what the right matching condition will be. But I will argue that from the string theory construction, I know what the matching is. OK, so let me go through the same steps I went through before. Start with solutions to the wave equation on PSL2R. And it's known that those are given by matrix elements of a matrix G in the various representations of PSL2R. And I will be interested in particular in representations labeled by J, where J takes the following form. So these are the principal continuous series representations. Now, on this group manifold, I will now choose a specific basis of wave functions. Namely, I will want the symmetry U1 left times U1 right, both of which are generated by sigma 3, to be diagonal. Our choice of basis of wave functions corresponds, on the previous slide, to a choice of basis of these alpha-beta states. And by choosing the states in this form, the wave functions will be diagonal. And in fact, for each choice of quantum numbers G and M, we know from SL2R representation theory that there's two independent states. So as a consequence, there will be four independent wave functions for each choice of quantum numbers. Now, the explicit form of these wave functions are known. And in fact, the group manifold splits into six different regions, such that these wave functions are smooth in the interior of each of the regions, but not so at the boundaries separating the various regions. And in fact, these six regions will correspond to the six regions of the space-time I drew before. But let me stress that although these wave functions are not smooth, they're still globally defined. Give me any point in the space-time, I can tell you what the value is of the wave function at that point. Now, given this basis of wave functions with the U1 times U1 diagonal, it's easy to construct wave functions on the COSET model. In particular, the result is that one should restrict to those wave functions that are U1 invariant. And technically, the condition is that m plus m bar should be 0. Now, there's one remaining step, doing the orbifold, the periodic identification. And this is also fairly standard. The result is that one should quantize the momentum along this circle and introduce twisted sectors or winding modes. And technically, introducing winding modes will amount to introducing wave functions with non-vanishing quantized m plus m bar. So now I've constructed the globally defined wave functions on the space-time I'm interested in. And let me make a quick aside at this point. Given this generalized Milne orbifold I constructed, one can zoom in at the singularity at UV equals 0. And this leads one to the Milne orbifold. And actually, it's interesting for some purposes to view the Milne orbifold as a limit. One thing is that the winding modes in the generalized Milne orbifold are very simple because the circles asymptotically go to some finite size. So winding modes are no more difficult than momentum modes. And using the wave functions for winding modes I have, one can take their limits and derive the wave functions for winding modes on the Milne orbifold. And this actually reproduces results of Mercus and Piolin, which were obtained with some more effort directly. The second comment is that this perhaps somewhat mysterious PSL2R prescription for continuing wave functions in this limit reduces to analytic continuation. And analytic continuation is equivalent to what Tolly, Turok, and Steinhardt did. However, it's only in this limit that the procedure is equivalent to analytic continuation. So analytic continuation is not a prescription that generalizes. OK, now that we have the space-time and the globally defined wave functions, let's use these things. And let me quantize a scalar field in this background. First, let's take the point of view of observers at very late times, regions 2 and 5. Then a natural decomposition of the quantum field is as follows, where the k minus minus star denotes positive frequency wave functions in region 2 and vanishing wave functions in region 5. And similarly, k minus plus star is positive frequency in region 5 and vanishes in region 2. So those have every right to be called positive frequency modes. So using this decomposition, let me define an out vacuum state by the following conditions. And this state has every right to be called empty in regions 2 and 5. Now, from the point of early times, regions 1 and 6, one would decompose the quantum field in a different way, where the k plus plus is now positive frequency in region 1 and vanishes in region 6. And one would define an in vacuum state as follows, and this state would be empty in regions 1 and 5. And in fact, if one imagines to be an observer starting out in region 1 and ending up in region 2, for instance, one could do more general things by demanding that the state should still be empty in region 1, but by not caring about what happens in region 6. And in that way, one can define some more general families of in vacuo. Now, what is the question in this language? The question is, assume the universe started out in some very natural initial state, for instance, the in vacuum I just defined. What does this state look like for observers at late times, for instance, in region 2? And to address that question, I have to give you the relation between the creation operators at early times and at late times. And well, we computed this matrix, it's completely known. And a noteworthy feature of this Bogoliubov matrix is that these off-block diagonal components B are non-zero. That means that particles have been created, namely compute the expectation value of the number operators in region 5 or region 2 in the in vacuum, and one finds a non-zero number, B squared. And in fact, a lot of particles are created. Consider, for instance, modes with a large momentum or winding in the Milner direction. Then this number is approximately 1. So one creates one particle in every mode for a certain set of modes. Let me now go back to the four-dimensional cosmology and discuss the fluctuation spectra. So again, I will use the globally defined wave functions and compute the two-point function at very early times or at very late times and then compare them. At very early times, the result is the following expression, which looks very much like the two-point function in Minkowski space, except for this shift of the momenta. However, at very late times, the results look similar, except for this factor delta that multiplies the integrand. And delta takes the following form, and let me now make a few comments about it. The first comment is that the fluctuation spectrum in general is modified by the transition. However, precisely in this limit where the spacetime goes over to the Milner orbifold, this coefficient B goes to zero. So in that limit, there's no particle creation and no modification, at least for the modes under consideration. Now, as far as this formula goes, the constant term 1 plus 2b squared has a simple interpretation in terms of the number of particles that were created. Think of the 1 half plus number of particles of the harmonic oscillator. However, this oscillating term contains more information. And it turns out that if one tried to do something simpler, for instance, forget about all these other regions and just look at regions 1 and 2, and try to write down a Bogoliubov matrix that relates an in and an out vacuum in those two regions, one would not be able to reproduce both the constant and the oscillating parts of this function delta. So the additional regions play an essential role in this discussion. And it's a final comment. In some of these generalized in vacua I alluded to, one can tune some parameters to suppress the particle production. Now let me elaborate on the role of these extra regions. Using this Bogoliubov transformation, I can write the in vacuum state as a squeezed state in the out Hilbert space. The coefficients can be computed. And the question is now, how would an observer in region 2 in the future describe this in vacuum? Well, the Hilbert space and the out vacuum have a natural tensor product structure. And as you can see from this formula, the in vacuum is a pure entangled state in this tensor product Hilbert space. So as with any pure state, I can associate with it a trivial density matrix. However, if one was interested in computing correlation functions purely in region 2, for instance, because one happened to live in that region, one would trace over region 5 and obtain the following non-trivial density matrix in region 2. And this is very similar to discussions of the BTZ black hole. So although there was a pure state at very early times, an observer in region 2 would call this state mixed. And of course, it's clear from the string theory picture where the information went, namely the information could leak out to these other regions. Okay, so everything I said so far was true in the limits where interactions are ignored. So G-string is strictly zero. Now, of course, one wants to include interactions in this model eventually. So let's try and do that. In particular, I will compute 2-to-2 scattering amplitudes of the kind that Liumor and Zyber computed. And I will do it in a simplified model, namely the Milne orbifold fold itself, which shares the same Cosmological singularity. So also in this model, one can compute, one can define the globally defined wave functions, vertex operators, and they are continuous superpositions of plane waves. And the superposition is such that the wave functions are invariant under the orbifold group. And let me now use those vertex operators to compute a 2-to-2 scattering amplitude. Now, I won't go through the details. Let me just say why it's possible to do this relatively easily. The reason is that we know how to compute in flat space four-point functions of plane waves. That's the familiar Virasoro-Shapiro result. And to obtain the correlation functions on this orbifold, one just has to do four integrals, three of which I've done already in this formula. Now there's one integral left to be done, and I will concentrate on the contribution from one end of the integral, namely V4 to infinity. And in that limit, the Mandelstam variables S and T take the following form. So this corresponds to the Reggie limit of the Virasoro-Shapiro amplitude. Now if one tries to do this integral, one finds the following expression, and it's easy to see that it's divergent unless there is a large transverse momentum exchange. So this is analogous to the divergence that Liumor and Zyberg found in the related model. And these divergences survive in a field theory limit where alpha prime times the Mandelstam variable t goes to zero. Now the question is, what do these divergences signal? In particular, technically, where do they come from in this computation? Do they come from the region close to the singularity, where it is an artifact from having this large space away from the singularity? So our claim is that this divergence actually signals three-level exchange of gravitons very close to the singularity. And let me give an argument for that. Start again from Dilaton gravity and go to the higher dimensional Einstein frame. Then one can write down the equation of motion for the graviton and the dilaton, and one finds the following result. Now the wave functions I'm looking at reduce to the following expression close to the singularity. There is some left moving piece and some right moving piece. And if one plugs in this expression in these formulas, one finds that the dilaton doesn't do too much, but the curvature blows up close to the singularity. So that's a signal of a large gravitational back reaction. Now, as an important side comment, if one were to consider profiles of the scalar field that only had the left moving component, for instance, then from these formulas, it's clear that only the plus-plus component of the Ricci tensor would blow up. And this corresponds to a much milder back reaction, for instance, the curvature scalar, which one would expect in higher derivative corrections, would be perfectly finite. Now let's go back to the relation between this computation and the string theory computation. Well, given this, given the back-reacted metric and dilaton, one can integrate them out classically, and one finds the following results. And by plugging in the behavior of the scalar field close to the singularity, one actually reproduces the divergence in the four-point function that came out of the string theory computation. Actually, since there's some time left, let me give a physical picture for why one expects this back reaction to be smaller. So close to the singularity, a scalar field behaves like a massless scalar in two dimensions on a cylinder. So a massless scalar field can do two things. It can move to the left or to the right with the speed of light. So if there's only a left-moving component, there would be all these waves traveling in the same direction and nothing would happen. However, if there were both left and right moving components, these waves would hit each other and they would keep doing so as they go up an infinite number of times along the cylinder. So that's the intuition behind this result. Okay, what do I conclude from this? First comment is that the simple string theory models we know of with the cosmological singularity tend to have various asymptotic regions. This may or may not be a statement that generalizes, just an observation. For instance, we don't know in string theory how to get a spacetime with a shrinking circle that goes to zero size and then expands again in this way. As a second comment, in the limit of free string propagation, the globally defined wave functions are known in string theory, and they can be used to compute fluctuation spectra unambiguously. And I argued that the additional regions played an important role in this. For instance, they will cause information to leak out, and they will give rise to a mixed state after the Big Bang. Now, as I argued in the end, large tree-level gravitational back reaction makes string theory perturbation theory problematic, and we clearly need better tools to push this further to include interactions. An interesting question is what happens when back reaction is taken into account? And there was work by Horowitz and Polchinski that argued that it would be complicated. So what are some interesting questions to look at in this context? Well, first, one thing that has not been studied in great detail yet is how the light winding modes modify this picture. For instance, very close to the singularity, one could expect that loops of these light winding modes would modify the picture, and it's actually something I'm very interested in. Forgetting about the back reaction for a second, one could try to do an additional Z2 identification to change the circle into an interval and come closer to what some cosmologists have been doing. And by introducing brains, one can try to get more interesting spectra and then see whether they survive the Big Crunch or not. And finally, it would be great to have some more robust tools, for instance, ADS-CFT, matrix theory, two-dimensional models to try and resolve this string theory, well, these singularities in a more controlled way. Thank you very much.
I think I remember that the Bogoliubov coefficient that you, this B square, keeps finite order one up to infinite energy.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
So you have particle production from modes which exit very near t equals zero and also re-enter very near t equals zero.
Yeah.
Right. So this seems to be in contradiction with the claim of Turok and Tolly that in a Milne background you do not produce gravitons in those modes. Is that all right?
This is not quite the same model as the LUC sets. They have these potentials, they can generate a scale invariant spectrum before the...
Yes, but this, of course, influences the, you know, the smaller frequencies. If you look at their paper on gravitational perturbations, they say that, of course, the modes which exit when the potential is relevant have a certain spectrum, but those which exit in the Milne phase are absent. And I think you are contradicting that statement in this model. Of course, it's not exactly the same.
Yeah, one comment is that in... So they were strictly in the Milne orbit fault close to the singularity. So in the limits where this reduces the Milne orbit fault, this production of particles was turned off, at least for the modes that they consider. So
That's why I'm a little bit confused, because if you tell me that the Bogoliubov keeps going finite up to infinite energy, I don't quite understand why you say in the Milne limit
the production
goes away. Okay.
This number of particles was this Bogoliubov coefficient b squared.
Right.
So b squared depends on the parameters of the model, for instance, the size of the asymptotic circle. Now, one can take limits where the size of the asymptotic circle goes to infinity, going to the Milne limit, and that limit b squared goes to zero.
You said there was a limit in your calculations in which you found that the fluctuation spectra were unaffected by what happened near the Big Crunch. And I wondered whether, if you're in that limit, but I change the initial state into something that's not the vacuum, two particle state, seven particle state, how does that affect the fluctuation spectrum? Does that also just propagate through, or?
I'd have to think about it, but I think so. This limit basically consisted of effectively of choosing boundary conditions that are purely reflecting in these additional viscous regions. So I wouldn't expect that there would be stuff leaking in from those regions. But I'd have to look at the details.
Your toy model Lagrangians had no brains in them. So what happens, what do you expect to happen qualitatively if you include brains with fairly large tension, like you have in the ekpyrotic type scenario?
Yeah, so it's actually something we're looking at now. So the hope is that if one finds versions of this model that are more stable and don't have these infrared problems, but there seem to be versions. One could do, say, an Oriente fault, such that there are deep brains that one can move freely. And in some region of this model, it will be almost supersymmetric. So one could expect that there will be very small potentials. And the hope would be that those potentials would give rise to more interesting fluctuation spectra that might be scale invariants, etc. So that's the hope. And once we have a model like that, it would be very interesting to see what happens as that kind of fluctuations goes through the crunch.
I guess my question was more whether the presence of the brains would totally change the nature of the crunch or not.
No, they would not. One can do, an Oriente fault of string theory that would preserve the solution at the classical level again. It would not be a problem to get a similar looking solution with an interval instead of a circle.
Are there further questions? No, if not, let's thank Ben again and break the conference.